Is it red over here?
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, it's on.
Which one is it?
Bob, you are so in trouble.
So in trouble?
You are so in trouble.
Okay, everybody. Oh, wait a minute.
You're on now.
Oh, okay, we're on, Bob. Oh, all right.
Okay. So I just want to remind you guys, we are now web streaming these. They're on slowspan.org. That's slowspan.org. There is a county live button for the archive. We're doing a special one for the county right now. So tell your friend. It'll be so exciting.
When I'm talking.
Oh, the contact information?
Yeah. Yes, we're in the final paper.
Ms. Evans, the meeting is yours.
Meeting is yours.
Good evening. This is the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. The meeting has come to order. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes of the previous meeting. Do I hear a motion? I so move. Dr. Thomas?
Before the movement is made, I want to double check to make sure that the minutes that were sent out to you were corrected.
You sent us an email that you made a correction, right?
I need to make sure that it is in the... I don't believe your version is what would be the correct one. It states on grand jury report, it says, Commissioner discussion, the pesticide task force is comprised of various representatives. There are concerns with the commitment to meet every year, and the commission agreed that by meeting every 3 years, a more complete report would be available. And it says Dr. Thomas agrees to meet once per year for a superficial report. That is not what I said. I agreed to pass on the concerns regarding meeting once a year and for producing a superficial report. Therefore, I would recommend a more in-depth report every 3 years.
Then the minutes will be changed to reflect that.
Thank you very much.
Now, shall we move on with the acceptance of the minutes? Are there any other changes or additions to the minutes?
I'll second that motion.
All right. If there is no further discussion of the minutes, they will stand as amended. All right. Next is public comment. Anyone who cares to comment on a subject not on our agenda tonight, could please come forward. When you get forward, if you would please say your name for the record.
Good evening. Actually, afternoon, thanks to daylight savings time. I am Eric Greening, and last Tuesday, May 2nd, the Board of Supervisors responded to a grand jury report on pesticide use at the agricultural-urban interface, and I can't remember that the Health Commission was in the loop on that particular grand jury report. And I'm not sure whether the departmental response would be coming from Environmental Health or from the Ag Commissioners. This was the essentially the Board of Supervisors / CEO response. But assuming this is going to get on your agenda or you request that it be on your agenda, there certainly are a few issues, although it is a far less superficial grand jury report and recommendations than the infamous one they did on the Planning Commission. But for one thing, by focusing on agriculture as the identified source of pesticide use, they obviously are ignoring urban use, particularly of herbicides and turf, soaking up more chemicals proportionate to acreage than most agricultural crops do, and the role of adjacent neighbors in contaminating children in residential areas, and certainly managers of large areas of turf, whether they be school districts, city parks department, golf courses, or whatever. The other issue that I had with the grand jury was they paid wonderful, exemplary attention to schools and childcare sites as places where children could be exposed, and the sites were therefore sensitive. They did not pay attention commensurately to homes, which is where small children and even more sensitive children, too small for schools or childcare, spend more time than any child does in childcare or in school, and is more likely to be exposed, particularly if there are carpets and people are tracking it in from the outside and it's not exposed to the weather. So I did have some issues with the grand jury report. I also had some issues with the county response, particularly the county's reluctance or refusal to implement recommendation number one, which essentially would recognize the authority of the Montreal Protocol in relation to methyl bromide. And I can remember back when methyl bromide's toxicity, both in terms of the global ozone layer situation and local exposure issues, was already considered so serious that it was supposed to go out of business in 1995, and then a special session of the legislature was called to extend its reach. But in any event, I just wondered if I had forgotten that you had looked at this, or maybe were going to look at this. Not a lot to chew on there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Is there anyone else who would like to speak?
Hi, my name is Mark Phillips. I'm from Atascadero, and this is the final chapter of the Arpad Pusztai story. In part one, we were introduced to the scientist and his work that showed significant harm on the health of rats eating his GE potatoes. We found that he was terminated after making cautionary statements about the GE industry. In part two, we were introduced to some of the techniques that were used by the Rowett Institute and the Royal Society to discredit Dr. Pusztai and his research. These efforts continued with individual scientists such as Dr. Nina Fedoroff. She tried to have us believe that Dr. Pusztai's research suffered because he was not a plant biologist, even though Dr. Pusztai has worked and published in the area of plant physiology for 20 years. She has also made incorrect and irrelevant statements, not in an effort to fairly discuss Dr. Pusztai's research, but to use any means available to discredit him. Her incorrect and misleading comments are picked up by others, including local GE task force members, and further disseminated to a largely ill-informed public. Ill-informed because media, such as the Tribune, consistently refuse to publish any information that indicates problems with GE technology. I know because we have tried to get them to do so. So some folks, such as myself, have quit relying on experts in the media, local or otherwise, and have researched these topics ourselves. For my part, I contacted Dr. Pusztai and asked him to respond to some of the charges that have been leveled against his research. He was kind enough to do so and generous with his time to answer questions that I'm sure he's had to answer many times before. I was quite impressed with how solid and convincing his rebuttals were. I was also shocked to find how second-rate the criticisms of his work have been. It became clear to me that the critiques of his work were not honest differences of opinion, but hit jobs. Given the comments that had been made regarding how flawed his research was, it seemed only fair and reasonable to me that he be allowed to respond to those charges. So I asked Dr. Pusztai, and he agreed to respond to three critiques of his work to be submitted by the GE task force. Given the vast differences in how Dr. Pusztai portrays his research and that provided by those who are trying to discredit him, it would seem as though any investigative body interested in the truth would be eager to accept Dr. Pusztai's offer. But our GE task force not only did not take up Dr. Pusztai's offer, they didn't even respond. Meanwhile, the GE lobbyists are busy passing preemption laws on the state level that will overrule local ordinances such as the one the people of Mendocino County passed. They are also busy passing preemption laws on the national level that will overrule state ordinances in case any of them try to pass a labeling law such as Oregon tried. They've also been successful getting the WTO to overrule laws passed by citizens of entire nations. In short, the system is working perfectly for the corporate interest it has been designed to serve.
Thank you, Mark. Are there any other public comments on subjects not to do with agenda items? Very well. We'll move on then. I'd like to introduce Allison Jones, who is here to give us a presentation from the Agriculture Water Control Board. See if I got all those words in the right place. The Regional Water Quality Control Board. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you, Chairman Enns, and good evening, and good evening, members of the Commission. As she said, my name is Allison Jones. I'm with the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, but we've since shortened it to Central Coast Water Board to make it a little easier. And I'm the lead staff on some fairly new regulations, water quality requirements for all commercial irrigated operations in the Central Coast region. We are a state agency. And but the state is divided up into 9 different regional boards, so each region has quite a bit of authority to adopt its own regulations. And we have a program that's quite different from other programs around the state, especially the Central Valley program. You may have heard of a ag waivers in the Central Valley, and this program is quite a bit different than that program. So I'm just going to briefly go over what the differences are and where the program is going right now. This is just a map of the Central Coast region, and as you see, we're not the largest region by any means, but we do have a significant amount of irrigated agriculture in this region. About 435,000 acres, and it's more than a $3 billion industry across the region. And just so you know what the counties are, it runs from a little bit of San Mateo County up in the north down through Santa Barbara and a little bit of Ventura County all along the coast. So we've got Monterey County, part of Santa Clara, San Benito, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara. Oh, I wanted to go back. I'm sorry. I know I can't do that. Just to give you an idea, we've estimated about 2,500 farming operations in the region. Many of them are small, under 50 acres, probably about two-thirds of them. And we only have a couple of staff that are actually dedicated to running this program. So we've tried to leverage our staffing with being pretty creative with how the program is set up and how it's run. Before the new regulations came into effect, we already knew that there were some significant problems associated with the agricultural areas of the region. For example, we're seeing pretty widespread nitrate problems in both surface water and groundwater in the agricultural areas. And we'd also had a couple of studies showing that there was toxicity from organophosphate and pyrethroid pesticides in those areas. Primarily Santa Maria area and Salinas where the studies were done. We didn't have data on the entire region. This map just shows you, this is a map of the region. The green is the areas where there's a lot of irrigated agriculture. And the red dots show areas where the surface water exceeds the drinking water standard for nitrate. Sometimes 4 or 5 or even 6 times the drinking water standard. And then this shows you where the groundwater exceeds the drinking water standard. Now, these are individual. The dots are fairly large in relation to the map, so it looks like it's covering everything. But in fact, there's a lot of data showing the levels in groundwater. So these, again, sometimes 5 or even 10 times the drinking water standard in some cases. And pretty strong correlation with agricultural areas, although we're not saying that those are the only sources. We also had a very prior region. So up around this Monterey Bay Sanctuary, the Farm Bureaus had formed a coalition to address water quality issues. And we have a program for sustainable wine growing, a number of other organizations that were already working on water quality issues. In addition, UC Cooperative Extension in this region was actually develop a pilot program for farm water quality planning called the Farm Water Quality Planning Short Course, and a number of growers in the region had already gone through that program. So we knew all about those things and wanted to build on what was already going on in the region. The impetus for the change was a change in the law, and in addition to the information that we had on water quality. Years ago, what the regional boards do is regulate through permits, generally called waste discharge requirements. But we also have an option to waive those requirements in cases of certain discharges. And years ago, back in 1983, the regional board had actually waived adopting any kind of permits for agricultural discharges. In the meantime, as I said, we had a lot more data, and when the state law changed, it caused all those old waivers to expire. And they put on new requirements for waivers. So you couldn't issue a waiver without having a lot of conditions on it and exceed 5 years. So these programs can only be put into effect for 5 years, and then they have to be reviewed. A new requirement that was added was also water quality monitoring, which was not there before. We took a little bit different approach than is generally taken in developing regulations. Partly because of the efforts that were already going on in the region by a lot of the agricultural groups and the fact that we had been working with them on water quality issues already, we felt it was important to sort of give credit for that, if you will, to acknowledge that people were working on water quality issues already, that we weren't just starting from square one. So we convened an advisory panel with a number of organizations from across the region, both environmental and agricultural, as well as ourselves, to try to come up with some reasonable conditions that would protect water quality and yet not be overly burdensome for agriculture, because monitoring can get very expensive. We wanted to make it a reasonable, practical program. This ran concurrently with our usual public hearing process, so we had a number of workshops before our board and did the meetings for about a year and a half before we adopted anything. Some of the participants on the advisory panel, the farm bureaus from most of the counties, or sometimes the counties got together, and sent one representative. Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo participated, the Ocean Conservancy, Environmental Defense Center out of Santa Barbara, and the Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. And then a number of other organizations were contacted, and they volunteered to not be on the panel, partly just to keep the numbers down, but wanted to be kept informed, so they felt that they had enough representation. We had a representative, and then we had Monterey Bay Sanctuary and some other agricultural representatives. My role in the program was basically acting as facilitator, which I'm not a professional, but I felt it was important that we, since we were working with agriculture, we had established relationships that we continue to build on that. And so I was the role of just facilitating the process, and then we had a representative of our own there as well to represent our interests in the process. What came out of that was so several recommendations. One was that the waiver have a tiered structure. So for people that had already gotten education and already developed farm plans and were implementing practices, they could have a lower reporting requirements than some of the people that hadn't already done those things. Another requirement was 15 hours of education and having an on-site farm plan that identifies practices to protect water quality. And then the final recommendation was that there be an option for group monitoring and that it focus on currently applied constituents, so agricultural constituents. So that's essentially the gist of the plan, is that there be a farm plan on site, that people get education, they have 3 years to meet that requirement, and there be monitoring, and that there be implementation and management practices. We also have individual enrollment and management practice reporting to us so that we have an idea of what people are already implementing and what they're planning to do. So this is just a little diagram to show how all these things fit together. I think management practices is really hard of the program. Education and planning to allow people to identify what they're going to do and what they're doing, and then monitoring to show if it's working. And that's the main purpose of the monitoring, is to show, is this program going to be effective over time? Are we improving water quality? Some of the practices that people can choose from, things like nutrient management. That's a requirement of the farm plan that it address nutrients. So there's a number of practices that people can choose to do. Another requirement is that the farm plan address irrigation management, because it's pretty key that you can limit the amount of water as much as possible, be as efficient as possible, because water is also carrying other constituents with it if it's moving off-site. So trying to limit what's moving off the farm. Pesticide management, things like integrated pest management. Erosion control, using vegetation if possible, but there's other techniques, of course. So this waiver was adopted last July 2004, so not quite 2 years ago. And because of significant industry outreach and a lot of effort by the ag community's part, then our enrollment is about 90% of the irrigated acreage at the present time. Somewhere around 1,600 individual farming operations have enrolled, and approximately half of those have already completed their farm plans and are identifying practices and have completed their education. So the other piece of this, as I said, was how do you know if the program is being successful? And this is kind of a long-term effort. The waiver does allow for region-wide cooperative monitoring, and it's being led by the industry. They formed a nonprofit with representatives from across the region, and they are conducting monitoring. The first year, they did 25 sites in two major watersheds, the Salinas and Santa Maria. This year, they've added another 25 sites. So the total program is a network of 50 sites across the region. They're in stream. They're not on property. And it's being supported partly by grant funding and then partly by grower dues. The sites were chosen in water bodies that were in agricultural areas, so where there's predominant agriculture, where we already knew there were water quality problems that had identified agriculture as a source of impairment. And also we looked at where we had high levels of nitrate in groundwater. The program is designed so that there's 25% of the budget set aside for follow-up. So when they see problems at some of these sites, then they can go in and follow up and try to solve the problem, find the sources and solve the problem. It's designed to be sort of a low-cost program. Try to keep the cost down, because if you had everybody monitoring individually, it can get hugely expensive. So it was designed to serve the needs, give us good information, and yet still be cost-effective. The data is reported directly to the regional board through an electronic format, and it goes into with our own region-wide Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program data. So we use this data as well as our own data to give us a better idea of what's happening across the region. What they're looking at are conventional constituents monthly, so things like nutrients primarily, flow, dissolved oxygen, generally things like that. And then they do toxicity testing. So they use three different species, and they do toxicity testing twice a year in the wet season and then twice a year in the irrigation season. They also do a sediment toxicity test once a year and then look at the invertebrates in stream to see if there's a healthy invertebrate community. This shows you, and I don't know if you can see, that it's phased in, as I said. The first year, the yellow dots show the first year's monitoring last year, and then the red ones are the ones that are the sites that are being added this year. And again, the green is the areas where there's a concentrated amount of irrigated agriculture. So it's not meant to monitor all the water in the region. We'll supplement with our own monitoring program as well. So it's designed to be compatible with our program, CCAMP. Also, we are working with the city of Salinas, their stormwater monitoring. And then as other cities do monitoring, we will try to coordinate with their program so they're compatible. And it's also compatible with the statewide ambient monitoring program. What we've seen so far, and we've got the first year's worth of data, haven't really analyzed a lot of it yet, but what we're seeing is about half of those sites did exceed the nitrate standard, which was not really a surprise to us. We also saw several samples that showed toxicity to test organisms. So the follow-up program is going to be looking at what's the cause, what's the source. We are not assuming that it's all agriculture, although these are areas that's been designed to try to bracket the agricultural areas, but there's still other influences, so we'll be looking at that as well. Again, this is just graph just shows the red line is the drinking water standard, and all the ones above are the ones that exceeded the standard. So about half of the sites. And this is just the basic approach. The site at the bottom is the long-term site, and then when they're working on follow-up, it'll be going upstream to try to figure out sources. So now we're working on looking at, over time, we'll be looking at trends, what practices are being implemented, whether practices need to be adjusted, looking at pesticide use in the area, what geographic areas contributing to each of those sites, and then outreach to the ag industry to see where practices need to be adjusted. And this is just kind of an illustration of that, looking at land use in the watersheds. So we were working on assessing the first year's data and then working with the industry on the follow-up projects. And our final task, looking at looking for non-filers, those who are still not enrolled. As I said, about 90% of the acreage is enrolled at the present time. So that's all I had to say, and I want to thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Any commissioners have questions? Commissioner Hetherington?
Thank you, Allison. When will Phase 2 added more sites last year?
Yes.
Are any of those sites in Slo County?
Yes. And you can't really see it where they are in the map, but I can just tell you generally. They're looking at Oso Flaco and Little Oso Flaco, Los Barros Creek, Arroyo Grande Creek, Warden Creek, Choro Creek, Perfumo, and Davenport Creek.
And
sites and all those.
When will you have results from those?
They submit quarterly, so we'll be getting some data submittal probably in June on the first quarter's testing.
And when will you be back to present those results?
Depend on how, if you want to wait for the full year, I can come back.
Actually, what I'm trying to do is plan in advance for the pesticide use task force. So that, you know, we're looking at what you're looking at. So if you could get me a list of the creeks that you're watching in Slo County, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any Commissioner Pinkle?
I'm not clear as to what else you are looking at. I mean, you're looking at nitrates, but what about heavy metals and what pesticides? Are you measuring those also?
Well, we're looking at toxicity, and then the next step of that will be identifying what's causing the toxicity if it is coming from a pesticide. The program is focusing on things that are being applied, so we're looking at primarily inputs from fertilizer and pesticides, not on heavy metals. But if you see toxicity and it's associated with a metals or something, then the next step would be to find out the source.
I understand there are a lot of old mines in this county and in this area that might be leaching out heavy metals. Is that correct?
There are some, yes. And we have, you know, other monitoring, other studies and things looking at those things. This program is really focusing on teasing out the ag input to water quality issues. So, again, if there's toxicity associated with something besides pesticides, then we would follow up on that.
This is biotoxicity. That's the idea.
Right.
Dr. Thomas?
It's three species toxicity testing. Is it a standard three species everywhere? What are the, just for my curiosity, what are the three species that are tested?
Ceridaphnia, water flea, a fathead minnow, and an alga solenostrum.
Okay. Great. And so an insect, fish.
Yeah, so something Ceridaphnia is very sensitive to organophosphates, the minnow is more sensitive to pyrethroids, and then the alga would be herbicides. Again, other things can cause the toxicity, so it's the next step is figuring out what's causing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Comment. Please approach and state your name for the record.
Eric Greening, and I'm very glad that we're hearing this, and it's It is quite informative. One of the, I'm going to ask a specific question that leads to a general question. One of the early maps showed the nitrate heavy sites in red, big red dots, and I noticed quite a cluster on the San Juan River southeast of Shandon in an area where there is very little irrigated agriculture. I'm wondering if it has to do with the biomedical goat operation that is in that stretch of creek. And if so, what I know that this area, number one question is, are there any sort of pseudo-pharmaceutical implications going along with the nitrates? And the other issue is, are we working with soil hydrologists? The San Juan River is a major percolation source into the Paso Robles groundwater basin, and it is the portion of the Paso Robles groundwater basin that is up gradient from the urbanized areas. That leads to the more general question of, when you are aware of a problem in the surface waters, do you work with soil hydrologists to trace whether this is a percolation area and whether this contamination is getting into the groundwater where it's much harder to remedy, or trying to stop it from getting into the groundwater before it becomes impossible to remedy? So those are my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Is there another public comment on the Water Quality Board? Mr. Arnold, did you?
Well, yeah, I would like to comment, but I wondered if Allison would like to respond to his question before I speak.
I take all public comment.
We take public comment first.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman Ans. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. And thank you, Allison, for your report. Since I grow things organically, my feeling is that's what we all should be doing. We wouldn't have to be monitoring for pesticides or probably nitrates either if everyone were doing things organically. I do wonder if this survey tests has any organic farms that they're testing for pollution levels, or if they're so small that you can't tell the difference between whether there's an organic farm in the watershed or not. But we can all grow our own to the extent we can and buy organic and go for the alternative that doesn't pollute our country in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any other comments? Allison, did you have something further you would like to say?
Well, I would try to respond a little bit to Eric's question. And if I can remember what it was. Because this program is focusing primarily on agriculture, and that particular, and you're referring to that particular site out there where
that's what that is.
I'm not certain. Yeah, and I'm not certain. A lot of the data that we have for groundwater is coming from other entities, and we've been trying to compile it and doing some mapping and doing some long-range planning. I don't know that anybody has specifically looked at that unless as part of regulating that particular operation. So it may be, and I don't know because it doesn't fall under this program.
And the general question of tracing threats to groundwater when you find something in surface water.
To the extent that we can, what we're trying to do is control those surface water discharges as much as we can. So trying over recognizing that there is an interplay, and in some cases we're seeing probably groundwater impacting surface water as well. So we're again trying to sort that out through partly through this program.
Thank you
very much.
Yep.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry. okay. Commissioner Hetherington, then Commissioner Pinkel.
I think it's interesting, and Eric, thank you for bringing that up, because I know that the goat biomedical research was actually ushered out of Santa Cruz because of groundwater pollution. Do we have somebody watching them closely up there?
I believe it's under permit. And I'm sorry, you reminded me that I didn't answer your question, which was, are we able to distinguish between the organic operations and the other operations through the monitoring, essentially? The way this program is set up, again, there's a site basically at the bottom or lower, partly below an agricultural area, so it's got a lot of contributors, number of operations, so no, we really, but part of follow-up is to figure out, is there a single source, or are there multiple sources, and that's when we would figure that out.
Commissioner Pinkholz?
No,
oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much again, Allison.
Thank you.
We appreciate your being here. We'll move to the next item on the agenda, the long-awaited GMO report. So if you'll give me a moment, I'll go to the podium. Showtime. During the Measure Q campaign in 2004, there was much information and disinformation presented to the public via various forums. The Health Commission was one of those forums, and after the measure was defeated, the Health Commission felt it would be useful to have a task force gather scientifically based information regarding the health implications of GMO food and foods and crops. So the GMO Task Force was formed as a working group to gather the aforementioned data and compile it into a report. This report is in written form, and it was finished this morning. And the report that we are giving you orally is hopefully a little more entertaining and not quite so detailed. I'm just going to briefly go through again. I gave this in our interim report, but just to remind you of the mission, and we'll go through this quickly. The mission was to provide the people of San Luis Obispo County with scientifically based information regarding the health implications of genetically engineered food and crops. And our goals were to gather the information and to liaise with the health department, the Ag Commissioner, and the supervisors, to work with the Education Committee to provide opportunities for the public on this subject, and to update the Health Commission, which we did once, and now we are giving our final report. And we were not mandated to take any political position on to whether the county should have legislation on the food or crops. And so with those goals in mind, we set out the following objectives. First of all, we needed to educate ourselves. And we needed to collect scientific-based research. We collected a lot of information, and we did hear speakers. We needed to learn and document the concerns of the public through the meetings and requests for information. And the idea was to provide a balanced report to the Health Commission based on evidence rather than prediction. And how did we do this? Well, we identified relevant scientific issues and the public concerns through the speakers and the public comment periods. And then we had much analysis and discussion of literature, and we gave a report to the commission. And the public concerns that came to the forefront were there was concerns about government regulations, uncertainty that government regulations and laws and standards are adequate to protect the public. There was much expressed opinion that labeling is needed. There was concern about standardization of testing protocols and compliance review. There was a general distrust of transgenic science. there was a lot of concern and worry about unintended effects, particularly allergenic reactions. There's fear of contamination of food crops by crops that are not intended for human consumption. There's also very much concern about antibiotic-resistant markers that are used in genetic engineering. There was a suspicion that the use of chemicals in agriculture have not been decreased by the use by genetically engineered crops, as purported. And, of course, a big concern about the susceptibility of children and other people who are immune-compromised and otherwise susceptible. As I mentioned, we've compiled a written report, which you've all received, and this report is organized generally as follows. Some of the concerns that I mentioned are listed and are discussed in more than one section of the report, but we will have a section on government regulation, laws, and standards, on standardization of testing protocols and compliance reviews, a discussion of general distrust of transgenic science, and allergenicity and unintended effects. We have a section on nutrient and genetically modified foods, nutrition, sorry, and genetically modified foods. And the National Academy of Sciences report, The Safety of Genetically Engineered Foods, we have used their recommendations to compare how their recommendations fit in with the expressed concerns from this county. And finally, at the end, we'll take a quick look at what other counties in California have done. So, the next part of our presentation is on government regulation laws and standards, and it is presented by Dr. Robbins.
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity to go over my portion. A lot of it I will read. A lot of it is complicated and will require you taking some time to read it as well. I would like to first state that the mission statement and goal of the Health Commission of San Luis Obispo County were quite specific. In the preparation of this portion of the report, every attempt was made to answer the questions posed by the FDA approval process. Frequently, the documents associated with this task force were either used verbatim or paraphrased as accurately as possible. Many sources were used as reference beyond the included bibliography that's attached to this portion, but present in the large GMO task force archives. Opinions presented in task force meetings were used as points of concern to be answered in this portion of the report. Every attempt was made to utilize this input accurately and reflect it within this report. This portion of the report in no way represents a position taken by the author or any other member of the task force. Its goal is to provide timely information and direction to further resources for the community of the County of San Luis Obispo. I'm going to go forward. In 1992, the FDA published its first extensive policy guidelines regarding genetically modified foods. I quote, bioengineered foods and foods ingredients must adhere to the same standards of safety under the enacted 1938 Federal Drug and Cosmetic Act that apply to their conventionally bred counterparts. This means that these products must be as safe as the traditional food on the market. The FDA relies on two sections of the FD&C Act to govern both traditional and bioengineered foods. The adulteration provision of this law post-market authority is given to the FDA to remove a food from the market or sanction its maker if the food possesses a risk to public health. The second portion of the FD&C law is food additive provision in Section 409. Under this section, a substance that is intentionally added to food is a food additive unless the substance is generally recognized as safe, or GRAS, which we'll talk about later on, or is otherwise exempt. Unapproved food additives are subject to the adulteration provision. The FD&C Act requires that there is pre-market approval of any additive, regardless of the technique used to add it to food. There are, however, no FDA pre-market approval requirements for foods generally, no matter what technique are used to develop them. The process is frequently misunderstood. Let's see, the process is frequently misunderstood because of the term voluntary consultation. The voluntary consultation. What is meant by that, and what are its goals? The consultation is the terminology for the process whereby the producer of a food product presents to the FDA its intention to bring to market a new or changed food product. The goal is to present to the FDA information in a specific format that confirms that three specific issues are addressed by this new product. They are that the new food product has not had its safety profile altered by genetically being modified. This includes change either as an increase or creation of a new allergen, alteration in its toxicity, or an alteration or increase in its anti-nutrient profile. The consultation, again, there's a great deal of misunderstanding in regards to this terminology, and I will quote exactly from the law. It is the goal of the consultation by furnishing relative information to the FDA that the new bioengineered food product fulfills the above three requirements and more. Once again, it should be remembered, however, that the food producer has the legal responsibility to ensure that their products are safe to consume. The consulting company presents to the FDA the results of a regimen of tests showing the safety of these products. In the handout that you'll receive regarding this portion of the text, you'll see a lot of the requirements on the consultative process. After the FDA receives the submission, the process of evaluation begins. The average period of time, according to FDA records, for completion of an evaluation is between 18 months and 3 years. The FDA is purported to work collaboratively with the company applying, and there's a great deal of back and forth information requested and supportive of the product to the FDA. When the FDA process is finished, the review, the applicant receives a letter from the FDA stating it has no further questions regarding the safety of the product. Toxicity, allergen, or allergenicity, and anti-nutritional products. We'll touch on those again. The specifics of the process. The evaluation of the bioengineered food safety submission must include a concurrence from every member of the biotechnology evaluation team. The 1996 Congressional Record Guidance states that there are at least five members of the evaluation team. They are to include a consumer safety officer, who is the project manager, a molecular biologist, chemist, environmental scientist, toxicologist, and nutritionist. An evaluation team may be supplemented with other experts as deemed necessary. Each member of the evaluation team is supposed to review the entire file, not the segment to which they're specialists in. Team members must document in writing all contact that they have had with the company or the applicant. The documentation is available to all members of the evaluating team. Again, in the documents that I have supplied to you, you will see the process and the requirements and information that's required. Finally, the entire team must concur with the final draft of the evaluation and its position on the product. Labeling. You will hear again much more about this in our concerned section and other speakers. Labeling. Section 403 of the FD&C Act sets labeling requirements for all foods, regardless of the manner of production. Under Section 403(1) of the FD&C Act, a food is considered misbranded if its labeling is false or misleading in any particular way. It states that labeling is misleading if it fails to reveal all facts that are considered material in light of such representations made or suggested in the labeling, or material with respect to consequences which may result from the use of the article to which labeling or advertising relates under the conditions of the use prescribed. The FDA has required special labeling on basis of it being material information in cases where the absence of such information may pose special health or environmental risks. Warning statements on certain protein products, for example, for phenylketonuric folks and others who are at risk for certain dietary intake. They may be taken to task if the label is misleading. However, in regards to biotechnology, FDA does not require labeling to indicate whether a food or food ingredient is a bioengineered product, just as it does not require labeling to indicate which conventional breeding technique was used in developing a food plant. Rather, any significant differences in the food itself has to be disclosed on a label. If genetic modifications materially change the composition of a food product, these changes must be reflected in the food's labeling. This would include its nutritional content, or requirements for storage, preparation, or cooking, which may impact the food's safety. Some of the biotech potential foods do have changes in the composition of the product itself. If bioengineered food were to contain an allergen not previously found in that food, information about the presence of the allergen would be material as to the potential consequences of consumption of the food. If FDA determined that this labeling would be sufficient to enable the food to be safely marketed, the agency would require that the food be labeled to indicate the presence of the allergen. FDA has received comments suggesting that foods developed through modern biotechnology should bear a label informing consumers that the food was produced using bioengineering. FDA representatives state that they have given careful consideration to this comment. However, they deny having any data or other information to form a basis for concluding that the fact that a food or any of its ingredients was produced using bioengineering is material within the meaning of the statute 201N, and therefore constitutes information that must be disclosed as part of a bioengineered product's labeling. Hence, the FDA states that it has neither a scientific nor a legal basis to require such labeling. The FDA has developed draft guidance for companies who wish voluntarily to label either the presence or absence of bioengineered foods and food products. Congress asked the GAO to review the policies of the FDA in regards to GMO foods. The FDA's overall evaluation process, it was stated, could be enhanced, according to some experts, by randomly verifying the test data that companies provide and by increasing the transparency of the evaluation process, including communications more clearly the scientific rationale for the agency's final decisions on GM food safety. Biotech experts from consumer groups and academia state that the FDA's evaluation process could be enhanced if the agency validated companies' test results on proposed GM products by reviewing raw data, the actual unverified test results. The credibility could also be enhanced if this was more transparent. It is also believed that occasional data verification by a federal agency is necessary to identify the risk of the agencies receiving faulty data from external sources and ensure that no one agent is allowed to control every aspect of a safety assessment. Officials from major biotech companies describe three types of data that they generate and submit to the FDA, primarily raw data, refinements and comprehensive interpretation of the raw data, and finally summaries of these interpretations. According to these officials and outside concerned population, the FDA has reviewed some summaries and in some instances the comprehensive interpretations, but very rarely, if at all, has ever reviewed raw data. Nothing prevents the FDA from doing this. To this time, they have not started to review raw data. Experts from consumer groups and academia have stated that the transparency of the agency's evaluation process for GM could be enhanced if the FDA described more clearly the scientific rationale for its safety decisions in its memos to file. The FDA concurs. guidelines issued by the Office of Management and Budget on the quality of information disseminated by federal agencies state that transparency is important in reviews of technical information and that these reviews should be conducted in an open and rigorous manner. Critics have stated that the FDA's current memos to file do not adequately communicate the scientific rationale for decisions. Some consumer groups have pointed out that the brevity of some of the memos and described them as perfunctory, summaries of company data that provides little or no insight into FDA's evaluation of the data. Likewise, the Council for Agriculture and Science Technology, a group of universities and companies established to provide a more scientific basis for analyzing and prioritizing agricultural issues, stated that the FDA does not adequately clarify in its memos to file the basis for its decisions on GM food submissions. There were a review of 50 products since 1997, and all of them lacked the above information. Consumer concerns. The issue of trust, both as to whom you should trust and why you shouldn't, is a recurrent issue in literature, international debate, correspondence, and believe it or not, here locally. The whom covers the gamut of U.S. government agencies, including but not limited to the FDA, USDA, and the EPA, all of which are involved in the pre-market review, approval, and post-market monitoring of bioengineered GMO products. To this list, many other international agencies have been added as GM foods have been approved to enter the farms and marketplaces around the world. The other whom are the large international corporations that are involved in the creation, production, patenting, and selling of GMO seeds and plant products. Examples of these companies would be Monsanto, Syngenta, Calgene, and others. There are large international agricultural producers replacing small farm, family farms such as Conagra, Cargill, Archer Daniels, Midland, and Kraft are also part of the sector accused of lacking credibility in this debate. Why not falls into many categories. A, most recently, the FDA has been found to be slow to act regarding pharmaceuticals with poor safety limits out in the marketplace. The concern is that FDA is far more stringent in its approval procedure for prescription drugs than it is for foodstuff. Pharmaceutical approval does not depend on voluntary consultation, but a step-by-step documented and reviewed evaluation. Therefore, it is suggested if the FDA has been shown to be inept on pharmaceutical review, which is complex and in-depth, how can there be any credible controls over GMO food products? B. An apparent gross conflict of interest between government agencies in place to protect the consumer and corporations dependent on acceptance and market success for its products. Advocacy groups point out that there is an apparent revolving door at both the middle and upper management levels between the government agencies and private industries. Directors of the USDA and FDA often come from the large firms described above, or go from government agencies to boards or directorships of the large companies they have regulated in the past. Although these appointments are frequently transparent and are public information, it does create a deep sense of distrust. Overdependence on government agencies regarding data supplied by private industry with an interest in a positive outcome of the studies. This, coupled with an admitted by the FDA lack of review of submitted raw data, is an area many groups find totally unacceptable. We're going to now go through some other important issues, which is GRAS and substantial equivalence. GRAS, or G-R-A-S, or generally recognized as safe. Under Section 201 and 409 of the FTC Drug Act, any substance that is intentionally added to food is a food additive that is subject to pre-market review and approved by the FDA unless the substance is generally recognized among qualified experts as having been adequately shown to be safe under the conditions of its intended use or unless the use of the substance is otherwise excluded from the definition of a food additive. For example, substances whose use meets the definition of a pesticide, a dietary ingredient of a dietary supplement, a color additive, a new animal drug, or a substance approved for such use prior to September 1958 are excluded from the definition of food additives. Sections 201 and 409 were enacted in 1958 as part of the Food Additive Amendment to the FD&C Act. While it is impractical to list all ingredients whose use is generally regarded as safe, FDA publishes a partial list of food ingredients whose use is generally recognized as safe to aid the industry's understanding of what did not require approval. The use of food substances may be grasped either through scientific procedure or a substance used in food before 1958 through experience based on common use. General recognition of safety through scientific procedures requires the same quantity and quality of scientific evidence as is required to obtain approval of the substance as a food additive, and ordinarily is based upon published studies, which may be corroborated by unpublished studies and other data and information. Regardless of whether the use of a substance is a food additive use or is GRAS, there must be evidence that the substance is safe under the condition of its intended use. The FDA has defined safe as a reasonable certainty in the minds of competent scientists that the substance is not harmful under its intended conditions of use. The specific data and information that demonstrates safety depends on the characteristics of the substance, the estimated dietary intake, and the population that will consume the substance. A GRAS substance is distinguished from a food additive on the basis of common knowledge about the safety of the substance for its intended use. The data and information relied on to establish the safety of the use of a GRAS substance must be generally available, and there must be a basis to conclude that there is consensus among qualified experts about the safety of the substance for intended use. Thus, the difference between the use of a food additive, which requires pre-market evaluation and approval, versus a GRAS substance, which does not. Post-marketing monitoring of both products are to be undertaken. For a food additive, privately held data and information about the use of the substance are sent by the sponsor to the FDA, and FDA evaluates those data and information to determine whether they establish that the substance is indeed safe under the statutes. Concerned consumers point out the passive, dependent position of the FDA on data presented by the developer. Generally, there is no review of raw data by the FDA. Transparency is poor, as the data is often presented as proprietary and not available for public scrutiny or peer review. For a GRAS substance, generally available data and information about the use of a substance are known and accepted widely by qualified experts, and there is a basis to conclude that there is consensus among qualified experts that those data and information establish the substance is safe. Substantial equivalence. It's all in the write-up. You have to read along. It's very complex. Guiding this assessment is the concept of substantial equivalence, which was introduced by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in 1993. Substantial equivalence is widely regarded as a sound and perhaps the only real basis for safeguarding the quality and safety of biotech foods, and provides an historical context based on centuries of experience with conventional foods. In addition to the OECD, this standard has been validated by many international scientific and governmental organizations, including, but not limited to, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization and World Health Organization, and the International Life Science Institute. The FDA's 1992 Statement of Policy on Biotech Foods, which lays out the agency's approach to biotech regulation, is consistent with substantial equivalence, and many other government regulatory agencies have adopted it in their regulatory reviews. Stated simply, this is the meat of it, substantial equivalence holds that a biotech food is as safe to consume as an existing food with the same compositional and nutritional characteristics and a history of safe use. The main food safety issues for biotech variety crops are changes in allergenicity, toxicity, nutrient composition and level, unintended effects, and the safety of antibiotic-resistant mark-encoded proteins included with the transgene. This evaluation seeks to establish that the new varieties are safe as or safer than crops produced by traditional methods. To date, evaluating the substantial equivalence of a new food involves measuring the bioavailability and concentration of important nutrients in the food, such as proteins, carbohydrates, vitamins, minerals, fats, and oils, to ensure that they fall within the normal range of variability for that food. As many foods contain naturally occurring toxins and anti-nutrients, levels of these substances also are tested and compared. Immunological testing also is conducted. In contrast, there are relatively few analytical studies done on conventional varieties of crops during their development. They break down after review into three categories. The new food may be found substantially equivalent to a conventional counterpart, substantially equivalent except for a few clearly defined differences, and not substantially equivalent. Any significant differences between the biotech food and its conventional counterpart is aimed to trigger additional tests and mandatory labeling. Regardless of these definitions, consumers and advocacy groups feel strongly that the above definitions do not represent the possibility of safety problems with genes inserted into DNA that is not consistent with the original organism. It is their contention that a modified organism does not represent any form of equivalence to the conventional food to which it is compared. Other concerns. Use of industry studies without transparency. It is the feeling of advocacy groups that studies, particularly short-term feeding studies, are not available for peer-reviewed evaluation because of the proprietary nature of the data. Large industry prepares studies including raw data and assumptions made to come to a conclusion. By the nature of the final study being classified by industry as proprietary in nature, third-party neutral peer review cannot be conducted. Results of such short and intermediate feeding studies are deemed by advocacy groups as both absolutely necessary and available prior to the release of a new GM food product. Long-term and multi-generational feeding studies. One of the most... can't go back. Can you go back one slide to the last, if you would, please? Finally, concerns regarding long-term and multi-generational feeding studies. One of the most heated issues in this debate currently relates to long-term and multi-generational feeding studies. Advocacy and consumer groups feel that precautionary principle is the best approach with GM foods. You'll be hearing all of these issues again. At the center of the precautionary principle is the concept of taking anticipatory action in the absence of complete proof of harm, particularly when there's a scientific uncertainty about causal links. The precautionary principle states that decision makers should act in advance of scientific certainty to prevent harm to humans and the environment. It addresses many of the limitations of current decision-making methods, problems of cumulative effects, and limitations of science. The ancient concept in medicine of first do no harm is the simplified concept. Biotechnology advocates, on the other hand, take a different view of both the value of long-term and multi-generational studies and the precautionary principle. Scientists and federal regulatory officials generally agree that long-term monitoring of the human health risks of GM food through epidemiological studies is not necessary because there is no scientific evidence suggesting any long-term harm from these foods. These scientists also state that it would be very difficult, perhaps impossible, to develop a process for monitoring the long-term health risks of GM foods because of the technical challenges in developing such a model. A recent report by the United Nations also expresses skepticism about the feasibility of identifying long-term health effects from GM foods. The scientists and federal regulatory officials generally agree that because there is no scientific evidence that GM foods cause long-term harm, such as increased cancer rates, there is no plausible hypothesis of harm. Researchers need such a hypothesis in order to know what problems to search for, test, measure, and identify. The biotechnology industry is also has concerns that the essence of precautionary principle is misused, and its application by advocates is to treat a lack of evidence as evidence against bringing out new GM foods. Again, I had the opportunity to present first. It's a lot of information. The following speakers will touch on some of the aspects of it. This embodies the current FDA considerations in regards to this topic. Congressional record entries have been listed in there. They go back to 92, 1997, 2001, 2002, and updates sent to me by some Echo Slow folks in regards to facts. It's all there. It's great reading. Thank you. Next is Dr. Scott Steinmuss.
Okay, Dr. Scott Steinmuss, I love that one. Doctor, I'm really a fake doctor, you know, the PhD type. Anyhow, I'm the gap filler, apparently in this presentation, and so there might be a few redundancies, but they'll fill in information that you won't see in the other presentations. And so Robbie's done a great job explaining how FDA regulates food. And transgenic food specifically, the way this started off, it really started back in 1986. Started when it was under the auspices of the White House Office of Science and Technology that put together something called the Coordinated Framework for Regulation of Biotechnology, and it was through that EPA, FDA and USDA were asked to regulate transgenic foods or transgenic products, and so it seems like each of these agencies has a responsibility for assessing this stuff according to several different acts that we'll see. So since Robbie did a great job with FDA, I won't spend any time on that. But the other two agencies that are involved are USDA and EPA. And first, the USDA, specifically a subservice of USDA called APHIS, which is the Animal Plant Health and Inspection Service. According to this act, as you can see up here, the Plant Protection Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, this is what gave USDA the authority to look at transgenic or biotech crops. And essentially, really, all they're trying to assess is can this crop become a weed? And if you use the definition weed, a plant that you don't want. Or the definition I like to use is a plant whose virtues have yet to be discovered. regardless, essentially USDA is trying to assess, will this have impact on the environment or on agriculture? USDA is also responsible for variety protection. And so that, of course, is a threat to agriculture, which gives them that gives them the authority to regulate this stuff. EPA, as the title of the service indicates, the Environmental Protection Agency, essentially they have precedence over biotech crops or foods when it involves a pesticide, the expression of a pesticide, or the expression of anything, a protein, anything that resists a pest. This is what causes EPA to be engaged in the process of evaluating. And of course, it's the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. This act was passed before they realized the significance of herbicides. I had to say that because I'm a weed scientist. So herbicides are obviously not listed here, but herbicides are under this act, which is why EPA is responsible. Anyhow, the last one, of course, is FDA. And I just wanted just a real quick summary on that one. Essentially, they're supposed to guarantee or assure us a reasonable certainty of no harm, and that pertains to all foods. And so that's where FDA falls. One of the agencies and one of the review processes that isn't listed here is NIH guidelines, National Institutes of Health, ones that I've been subjected to as a researcher at Cal Poly and also at UC Davis. Essentially, when I submit a grant proposal, NIH guidelines stipulate that I need to submit my proposal through a biosafety committee that exists on campus, which, by the way, I was apparently the first one to run into that at Cal Poly, because there was no biosafety panel at Cal Poly when I submitted my first National Research Initiative grant. But anyhow, so anybody who gets federal funds will be under this I guess, jurisdiction of NIH guidelines. So anyhow, the regulatory process, the USDA and EPA, they're really involved in quite a few of the field permit, greenhouse permits, permits to move this stuff around. This is when USDA and EPA are both involved. And again, it's the threat to environment, threat to agriculture. This is part of the process that EPA and USDA are involved with. There's a 9-step process that you're going to find in the write-up that we gave you, and that involves many steps involving USDA. Again, the field trial, greenhouse study, permitting process, and then also EPA. And you'll see that there's asterisks listed where there's chances for public input. What you'll notice at the very end is FDA review. There is no asterisk there. There is no chance for public input there, which, you know, of course, is, you know, something that is of concern. Robbie already discussed quite a bit of what the FDA does, and you'll see that in the section on the report talking about safety assessments of transgenic crops, that there's a whole list of substantial equivalents in that whole bit. The very last step is the environmental impacts, things looking at gene flow and outcrossing. These are concerns for USDA. Will this become a weed? Will it confer weed-like characteristics to something else that is growing near it? You'll also notice in the report that we've talked about calls to revamp the whole regulatory process, essentially in both directions, make it more stringent and make it less stringent. And that might seem kind of odd. Make it less stringent. Why isn't that kind of the problem in the first place? And what scientists are really behind this, and it's the governmental regulations that makes it extremely expensive for a university, a public entity, to come up with a new transgenic product. Extremely expensive, like cost prohibitive. The only way that it can be developed is through the funds and the investments of a private company. So scientists have been saying, hey, you know, we need to do this more on a case-by-case basis. And essentially, these scientists are trying to list these risk categories: low risk, medium risk, and high risk. The lowest risk would be where there's no material change to the plant. Again, this is a reasonable scientist's view. Is there real material change or not? And if it's not, then of course it falls under the low risk. The higher risk categories would be things like producing a pharmaceutical crop, okay, or an industrial crop. And that's what this picture is in the bottom right here. This is an Arabidopsis plant that's producing plastic transgenically. And, you know, again, that it's transgenic makes it scary to some folks, but producing biodegradable plastics, as you'll see in the little sub-picture, should be quite attractive. So the point is that biotechnology is a tool. It has incredible benefits, and it also has incredible it can have incredible risks as well. So some of the general distrust of transgenic science really starts off with the Pushtai issue. There's a book that was continuously held up at some of our meetings, written by a fellow named Jeffrey Smith, who wrote the book's called Seeds of Deception. And the first part of the book talks about a researcher named Arpad Pushtai, who essentially was fired from the Rowlett Institute it's hard to decide why he was fired. Some would say he went against the biotech industry, and so he was fired for that reason. Others would say maybe the way that he handled the whole going in front of TV, the mass media, and then subjecting his research to public peer review or to peer review, maybe the order was out of it. Regardless, our panel wasn't supposed to decide whether his firing was legit or not. What we were trying to do was figure out was Pushtai's study worth considering as a serious concern, and in the study, Ewan and Pushtai. It's published in The Lancet in 1999. Essentially, what he did was he had a rat study where he showed that transgenic potatoes that produced a lectin was the rats had suffered significant higher levels of gut lesions compared to the other treatment groups. And in the very next issue, the letters section was loaded from comments from many different scientists in the field criticizing the study, mostly for, you know, the logical reasons that 6 rats per treatment group, 10-day study, the fixation methods were flawed, just many, 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 many criticisms. Anyhow, plant biologists have looked at this issue, and our big question was, were the transgenic potatoes substantially equivalent to the parent line potato, where the expressed protein that was in the transgenic potato, were those two potato lines exactly the same, except for the lectin that was transgenically produced? The only evidence we could find was that those two lines were not exactly the same, except for the lectin being produced. What this leads to is that the potatoes that were being compared were like comparing apples and oranges. The plant biologists have said that these potatoes were, what he saw was what we call somaclonal variation. And somaclonal variation is when you start off with a single transformed cell and you try to grow that cell out into a transgenic plant. Because of random mutation, because of the very narrow genetic variation that you start with it when you use a single cell, you can end up with a very different plant than the parent line. So this transgenic potato was genetically different just from the get-go, not only because of the transgenic lectin that was in there, but for other reasons. And so he was seeing these differences because of that. Potatoes are already naturally very toxic. They come from a family that's known to be very toxic. And as a plant biologist, when we do tissue culture with potatoes, we have to always watch out for these toxins reintroducing themselves in potatoes, because they can come back. So potatoes are just dangerous to start with. What you'll also find in that very same issue that Pushtai had published his article in, you'll find in the very next letter is an article talking about how this particular lectin, same lectin, will bind to human white blood cells, and essentially dictating that this stuff is not ever going to find its way into the human food chain. So, or that it shouldn't. Basically, we tried to assess these differences with Arpad himself, and the responses that I got personally, I didn't understand. So I ran it past other plant molecular biologists, including National Academy of Sciences members like Robert Goldberg, Kent Bradford, and they don't know what those responses mean either. So we don't know what's going on. The bottom line is that the British Royal Society, which is the group of scientists from Britain, has basically written the study off as reported that no scientifically meaningful conclusion could be reached from Ewan and Pouchet's experiments. So our panel, which is not made up of scientists like the British Royal Society, we don't compare. So we conceded to them. So this is just plant tissue culture. Essentially, some of the random transgene insertion and unexpected effects, that we use gene guns to insert genes. Yes, the initial process is very random. Very random. And in fact, most of the time, it's catastrophic to the cells. And it's the one in millions that actually transform successfully that are ever developed and brought forward for further screening processes. So yes, it's very random. And there are very, very, quite a few unintended effects from those initial lines. But do they ever see them? Do we ever see those finding their way to the marketplace? As far as our screening techniques, you know, we don't think so. There have been cases where we've seen unexpected results come up. For example, increased virulence with the expression of interleukin-4 in a mouse pox virus. So it turns out, yes, that's not a good thing. But the point is, you'll find a reference in here how that could have been predicted before it ever happened. And would that ever make it to a marketable product? You know, probably not. Very highly unlikely. So again, I'm not saying that we should trust, you know, government agencies, but they are. But these things pop up, and science has caught it. This is a typical gene gun. These cost about $16,000, which is pretty darn cheap. And you can buy these from companies like Bio-Rad. And so this is pretty available equipment. We also heard a presentation from the public about comments from an investigator down at down in San Diego named David Schubert. And David Schubert is a respected cell biologist, and he essentially listed several pleiotropic effects. And just in case you don't remember what pleiotropic effects are, they are when a single cell can affect many traits. So if you do a change on a single gene, that can have several effects on different traits. That's what pleiotropic effects are. And indeed, when we blast DNA in plant cells, you will get these unintended effects, and you will sometimes see these pleiotropic effects. Back to the regulatory process that I talked about just before in the previous slide, there's been call to look not at the genotype, but at the phenotype. What is the plant actually expressing? Right? What is it actually doing? Yes, there are genes in there, but that are different than the original genome. But what are they actually doing? So essentially, David Schubert's comments that were published in Nature Biotechnology in the correspondence section were met in the next issue with a number of letters that were very critical of his views. Primarily because what Dr. Schubert had talked about were, his sentences were all with may or could, and very predictive. And indeed, things can happen, but that doesn't mean they will. They can, but that doesn't mean they will. Essentially, what the counter argument was really that all of these scenarios that Dr. Schubert has alluded to all arise in the course of evolution and are unlikely to pass the screening cascade to which all new crops are subjected. And these letters were written by some of the most significant molecular biologists in the country and in the world as well, including many of his colleagues down at the Salk Institute in San Diego. Regardless, Dr. Schubert is a respected cell biologist, and his comments should be taken seriously. This is a slide of a radiation mutagenesis breeding facility in Japan, and essentially what they use gamma radiation to try to generate different crop varieties. And of course, most of the gamma radiation, if you look at the very center of that picture right there, most of the plants are killed by the gamma radiation. If you come some distance out from the center, you'll find some plants that actually express desirable characteristics. Most of the time, it's deleterious. Most of the time, there's nothing happens if it's not killed by the gamma radiation. Next most is deleterious. Very rarely, you'll get some desirable characteristics. Is this an important part of crop breeding? Absolutely. Hundreds of varieties of crop varieties that we eat, including organically grown varieties, have been produced by radiation mutagenesis. And the National Academy of Sciences report dictates that radiation mutagenesis will produce more unintended effects than with biotechnology, using transgenic technology. Last slide relates to allergenicity and unintended effects. This was a big issue that was brought up by the public during public comment period. And allergenicity, essentially, this is not just a random, not looked at process. Allergenicity is a pretty well quantified science in the detection, and methods have been pretty well defined. Essentially, most of the human allergens belong to just a few protein superfamilies. And you'll see some of the list in there, like bromelain and copen, I think is the other big family. There's another family in there as well. But these families are very well characterized. If you've ever gone to some of the websites where you can see protein structure, and you can actually, you know, there's a free available software that us researchers use all the time to do protein comparisons and look for homology. you'll see that these tools are already available. And transgenic scientists use these tools to try to anticipate allergenicity and allergens that might show up in food. One of the things that came up was the Brazil nut, that the protein from the Brazil nut was inserted into soybean to increase the methionine content in soybean. And yeah, it did do that. Unfortunately, there were concerns about the allergenicity because of Brazil nut. When Pioneer Hybrid International, the seed company that produced this thing, when they were doing their testing of this, they found that the serum from people with nut allergies, when it reacted, when their IgE levels shot up, that they agreed with the FDA that this shouldn't be moved to market. So the thing was completely axed. So again, can bad things happen? Absolutely. But science and our detection methods are designed to try to catch these things. It should also be noted that that allergens can also be removed with biotechnology. That because we can identify the proteins that cause allergies, removing these things is a fully capable possibility with biotechnology. So just as allergens could be introduced, it's more likely because we know what to recognize that they could be removed. And so biotechnology should be more viewed in the removing sense than as an introducer of new allergens, certainly at the point when it reaches market. Another concern came up with horizontal gene transfer. This is my last comment. And this came up with an article that by Netherwood et al. That showed up in Nature Biotechnology in 2004. And what that study showed was that transgenes, modified EPSP synthase, the Roundup Ready gene in soybean, was detected in gut microbes of people who had compromised gastrointestinal tracts. And compromise means that they had a tube connected to the ileum. Yeah, like a colostomy. But it wasn't really, it was, ileum, I guess, is higher up, and the colonoscopy is quite a bit further down. Anyhow, so they found this transfer into gut microbes for this EPSP synthase, the Roundup Ready gene. And so this brought up concern about this horizontal gene transfer in microbes, and specifically, it brought up the concern about using antibiotic markers to help us select for successful gene transfers when we use the gene gun, or we use agrobacterium mediated or electroporation, or some of the other techniques we use to transfer genes into a new host, a new plant cell. Antibiotic markers. Antibiotic resistance markers are there should be resistance in there. The one that was commonly used is for kanamycin, and I think kanamycin is not a very common. Not that this is an excuse, but kanamycin is not a very common antibiotic. It's used for tuberculosis, and it's not commonly prescribed because of the side effects. But anyway, regardless, the most common biotech crop we have out there is the Roundup Ready, and it didn't need an antibiotic resistance marker. The Roundup resistant gene was its marker. So essentially, we lace those petri plates that are growing the cells from tissue culture with Roundup, and only the cells that have the Roundup Ready gene will be successful. We don't need to use antibiotics. Also, there is quite a bit of technology that's come out where we don't need to use the antibiotic resistance marker as a selectable screen. There's been discovery, thanks to Arabidopsis, the lab guinea pig for plant biologists, there's been discovery of plant-based markers that can be used for selection, that can also confer antibiotic resistance just from the plant's own genome. And the likelihood of that transferring is very, very low. The biological hurdles are huge. So, anyhow, there are ways of dealing with the antibiotic resistance marker. Yes, the AMA has recommended not using antibiotic resistance markers in the screening process, and so that concern has been addressed, and it is and it's being dealt with in research labs. So with that, I would like to pass on the next to the baton to the next set of folks. Dr. Ralph Jacobson will be, and he's a fake doctor like me. Sorry. He will be talking about the nutritional aspects of GMO foods. Thanks.
It's very obvious to me listening to other people speak that when you have a group of people who cooperate together by dealing with parts, sometimes you see some repetition, and there will certainly be some repetition in what I'm presenting. But I guess if you hear something for the third time in a different tone, some of those are going to sink in somewhere along the line. So if we look at nutrition, we all eat. You know, we can't get by without eating, and so nutrition is probably the one area that is likely to impact virtually everyone. And so the two questions that we might ask about GE foods is, are they nutritionally sound, and are they safe? And I think those are very reasonable questions to ask. When I was presenting this to the group, some people said, it sounds like you're trying to scare us about foods in general, and maybe some of the things that I say will sound like I'm trying to scare you about food in general, but again, I don't think we can do too much about that. Nutritional studies are very complex and very difficult to perform for a number of reasons. I mean, you say, well, you give somebody food and you can see what the effects of that food are, but it is very difficult to do a really sound scientific nutritional studies. Establishment of control groups is very, very difficult. It's very difficult to put human beings in a situation where you have absolute control of their diets. The test specimens are likely to have some genetic diversity. And again, unless you're dealing with only a particular breed of laboratory rat that has been bred to be genetically pure, you have no way of determining what the differences will be in different people. There's a great deal of uncertainty in using animal models to predict human results. Primates require vitamin C. There are very, very few other mammals out there that do require vitamin C. And then there are ethical concerns when you want to do studies on human test subjects. A long time ago, conscientious objectors, prisoners, and graduate students were the likely people who you did your experiments on, and we don't have conscientious objectors anymore. You're not allowed to do it with prisoners anymore, so that only leaves graduate students as a likely group, and I'm not sure that all the graduate students want to do that. The problem in looking at nutritional tests is that it's very difficult to look at long-term effects. Acute effects are relatively easy to see. You eat something, you get sick. You know, you have an allergic reaction or whatever. Those things are very easy to find. Or the animal gets sick, you know, and those things are very easy to find. But long-term effects are very subtle, especially if the changes are minor. And tracing a new disease problem, new in quotes, disease problem to specific causes is exceedingly difficult to do. The time lag between a change in diet, especially if it's a minor change in diet, and the appearance of a disease can be 20 or 30 years. It's sort of like developing, looking at something, trying to determine if it's carcinogenic. It might take 30 years for you to figure out whether something is carcinogenic. I'll give you two examples there in terms of food. Bleached flour was introduced sometime shortly after the First World War. So I think that timing is correct. We didn't even know of the existence of vitamins at the time that bleached flour was used. And on a more recent level, we now, if you look at any food that contains fat, it tells you how many, it tells you the percentage of trans fats that are in there. Whatever trans fats are, you know, now we know how much is in there, and people who have developed techniques for developing margarines and so forth and so on that don't involve trans fats are making a lot of money on their patents at this point. We're not even certain what trans fats do, but we are concerned about them. And then I'll make a reference to Pottinger's cats in the next slide. Just from my personal experience reading, teaching nutrition, being a, I'm a molecular biologist, biochemist, but I've taught a lot of nutrition. Within a balanced diet, a nutritional effect, a minor nutritional effect, may be impossible to detect. First of all, there are likely to be only small amounts of any new substance in the foods. The otherwise balanced diet may mask the effects, and it may take many generations for the effect to be seen. The Pottinger's cats reference was withdrawal of, I think they put them on a vegetarian diet, absolutely, and after about four generations, they were no longer capable of breeding. And that's, but it took that long, it took four generations to dilute out something very, very essential. And I didn't realize until a couple of years ago, when I had a student who wanted to be a veterinarian, wrote a paper on it, that the cat family are obligate carnivores. You know, and I didn't know that. You know, I mean, they got to go out and get those mice for you. You know, I mean, it's necessary for their survival. So, with that in mind, what can we test? And you've heard, this is where you begin to have heard some things before. Traditional foods and those modified by traditional methods are rarely tested. There's very little testing that is absolutely required. Added to that, we may only know the identity of a small percentage of the contents. My favorite example here is chocolate. There are over 2,000 ingredients in chocolate. We know what about 200 of those 2,000 are. You know, I mean, in terms of knowing their chemical structure and maybe even, you know, what they might be doing for the chocolate. You know, in most cases, we can, even if we can figure out what they are, we don't know what effect it has on making chocolate such a good thing. Scott mentioned this, certain crop families, particularly the Solanaceae, which includes potatoes, tomatoes, and tobacco, are known to contain very toxic substances. So the traditional breeding techniques, which is either crossbreeding or selective breeding or irradiation, often can aggravate the content of those toxins. And again, we know to look for that because we know those toxins are there. But suppose we don't know that something's there. So if we're looking at nutritional questions with respect to GE foods, what is specific or unique due to the genetic modification? And I think that that's where we would have to concentrate in looking at this. The possibilities, and again, you've heard some of these. There may be no unexpected differences after GE modification. The nutrition content may be changed as expected. You might be increasing something, vitamin A or omega-3 fatty acids, or you may be decreasing something, trans fats, omega-6 fatty acids. The growth or disease resistance in the crop may be as you predicted. The GE modifications may alter the levels of other nutrients or toxins, and that might affect the digestibility. And there are examples out there. They're in the report, examples where these problems have occurred. GE modification may produce allergenic effects. This is the third time you've heard that one, especially from added proteins. But again, it's something that we really have to worry about. In some cases, when you add a protein, even though you were working from the gene for that protein, the technique that you've used to clone that gene involves modifying it slightly, usually at the leading end of that protein, and that may be allergenic, whereas the rest of the protein wouldn't be allergenic. Or you may induce the production of other allergenic substances. When you add a gene, it may turn on or turn off other genes that could have some detrimental effect. And again, you've heard some of those things. So, and again, what can happen? Concern that the genetic markers used in the modification process may result in undesired effects. This has not been observed with respect to humans anyway, but it's certainly a possibility. And one of the things that I don't think we've talked about is that there may be a higher bar for safety testing necessary when the added information comes from a distant genetic relative or we cross kingdoms or phylum. The two major crops out there are Roundup Ready crops and BT crops, the BT corn particularly. in both of those cases, the genetic modification was made by adding a bacterial gene to the plants. And it's rather interesting because we talk about increasing nutrition or whatever with GE foods, but the commercial use of genetically modified crops is all for the advantage of the grower at this point, not for the advantage of the eater. And that in itself is an interesting concern. So, if we were making suggestions, the essential testing would include known toxins, known allergens. We need to look at the nutrient profiles, which are to make sure that they're substantially equivalent to known varieties. If we have enhanced the nutrition in some way, we have to be sure that that enhancement is an adequate amount to do the job. We have to make sure that it's bioavailable, that it gets into the body and does what it's supposed to do, that there's a high enough concentration of it so that it can be absorbed effectively. New foods, GE or traditional with obvious toxicity, will likely never reach the market. And I think that's very, very clear. Word of mouth of human beings talking about how bad a particular genetic variety of tomato at an earlier time was enough to kill that product in a very, very short period of time. So what are the concerns which are specific to SLO County? Well, we cannot keep foods from other areas from entering the county. So that's a no-brainer there. I mean, maybe, I don't know, we could build a 17-foot wall or something like that, I suppose. And then the labeling for allergens and problem metabolites, for example, aspartame, anybody who does NutraSweet, there's that little label there that says caution phenylketonuriates. This material contains phenylalanine. It's already required, and it must be enforced. Enforcement is the big thing. I actually read a label about a week ago, and then I couldn't find the label again, and it said, caution, may be exposed, the equipment used to process this food may have been exposed to allergens such as nuts, such and such, and such and such. And that's a new, I had never seen that on a label before. You're going to see it on a heck of a lot of labels in the future. So one of the concerns, and I think, and this really addresses the cooperation with your education committee, is the possibility of dealing with education. I'll take the second one first here. Americans tend to have more problems from overnutrition than undernutrition. That's an interesting thing, and I'm not sure how GE foods are going to answer that problem. But we certainly could develop educational pamphlets. We saw one in our meetings, and I think it's part of the final package was produced by the University of California at Davis, a very, very interesting one, just educating about GE foods in general, what are they not, and so forth and so on. We can do workshops with people. We could, and it isn't listed there, but we could establish a speakers forum of people who would be available to go out and talk about that. But I think that if we're looking at nutrition, my personal belief here is that it needs to be integrated together with not only the problems that might be associated with GE food, but an overall nutritional education package. So that ends mine, and we will now hear about the NAS report from Dr. Michael Broadhurst, another one of the popular form of doctors who are here tonight.
Okay. Before I start my comments, I wanted to just briefly thank the other members of the task force. It's been a pleasure to work with. Lots of helpful conversation and input, and everybody's been very objective in this process. So I'm supposed to talk about the National Academy of Sciences report. This section of my comments will focus on a report from the National Academy of Sciences that appeared almost 2 years ago. The report discusses in detail the issues surrounding genetically modified foods, not just those from genetic engineering, but from other methods such as conventional breeding or mutation processes. The purpose of the report was to develop recommendations for improved methods of testing GE crops and foods for possible unintended health effects. I did bring along my only copy of the report, and I'll pass it around and give you a chance to peek at it. In case any of you are interested in some light reading, here is my only copy. Okay. To begin with, it is important to note that one main conclusion from the report is that unintended health effects are possible with new foods when new foods are introduced, regardless of their method of genetic modification. An example given in the report that you have is a kiwi fruit, which was first introduced in the 1960s, and in this country anyway, and it was a result of conventional breeding rather than genetic engineering. Once marketed, kiwi was found to cause allergenic reactions in a few people, and some were quite, in many cases, they were quite severe. Nonetheless, the report recommendations are focused on a more national, if not global, level. As such, they are difficult to overlay with the specific issues that we have here in San Luis Obispo County. Still, I believe they can provide some insight. Of the report's 7 recommendations, 2 deal with research needs and 5 pertain to assessing unintended health effects. With the next couple of slides, I intend to provide 4 examples of concerns that we have heard from the public. This is only 4 out of perhaps a couple of dozen issues that have been raised, but I hope they'll be illustrative. The other issues are similarly matched up with the commentary from the NAS recommendations in the report, and you've been provided these in the larger report that you received from us. Okay, one thing we heard several times from the audience during public comment was the question, why aren't genetically modified foods labeled? The National Academy of Sciences report addresses this issue indirectly, but only under the existing FDA guidelines that Dr. Robbins discussed. Basically, compositional changes in new foods can trigger labeling. But the report goes beyond that in recommending post-market surveillance for new foods when there are compositional differences from the parent foods. This would be new territory for the FDA. We've also heard a great deal of concern that it is not possible to target where new genes end up and when introduced into the plant's DNA, and that powerful regulatory elements were used to ensure expression of the new trait. There is concern that these powerful regulatory elements and the random placement of genes could also lead to unintended health effects. The National Academy of Sciences report recommendations address this issue, as they do most others, by recommending follow-up testing of new foods when they contain novel substances or atypical levels of substances already found in the food. There is also a recommendation to standardize testing protocols. There's also concern on all fronts that most people do not have the technical knowledge or experience to assess whether or not something should be considered dangerous. Some of these concerns stem from mistrust of the government's ability to properly regulate new foods. The National Academy of Sciences report recommendations, when implemented by the agencies, should help attenuate such fears by instilling more confidence in the government's ability to ensure that new foods are safe. And one thing I didn't emphasize a couple slides ago was that actually that report that you have that's being circulated around was commissioned by the FDA, the EPA, and the USDA. Okay, my last slide on the NAS report. Finally, it is well known that children can be more susceptible to some types of health effects. The National Academy of Sciences Recommendation 4 specifically addresses this issue by recommending that a database be created on susceptibility of various subgroups of the population, including ethnic groups and children, to various types of health effects such as allergenic responses. In addition, there are a few other issues that have emerged that may or may not match up well with the National Academy of Sciences recommendations. I picked the ones that I felt were the most important to discuss here. Others can be found in our report. First, a word on GM crops, and this has been alluded to by a couple of previous speakers, but I thought it was worth them getting it out in black and white. There are two main traits out there that currently dominate production of GM crops, both in the U.S. and other parts of the world. Roundup Ready uses a bacterial gene to make the crop tolerant to being sprayed with the herbicide Roundup. Many existing crops exhibit this trait. Main existing crops exhibiting this trait are soybeans, corn, and cotton. Other crops, such as alfalfa, are beginning to use this trait. The second dominant trait is insect resistance to particularly damaging worms due to incorporation of a bacterial gene into the crop. The worms are killed by the protein before they can do their damage. This trait is found mainly in corn and cotton. The main benefits of these crops, as has been pointed out, is to the growers in terms of better and easier control of worms and weeds. However, the consumer benefits because the crops can be produced more economically. As a consequence, the produce will be less costly. It is important to note that the first of these crops were grown on a large scale in the middle 1990s, and therefore foods made from these crops have been in our food supply for nearly 10 years now. Finally, a number of new crops with potential to directly benefit the consumer will soon be introduced or in research stages. An example of these is golden rice, which has been genetically modified to provide pre-vitamin A. It will benefit those in cultures where rice forms the staple of their diet. In most of these cultures, vitamin A deficiency causes a variety of serious health effects. This slide provides an example of the approval process for seed currently available to growers, such as myself. Insecticidal corn. I forgot to introduce myself to the extent that I am a local farmer here in San Luis Obispo County. The proteins found in competitive varieties of this corn kill worms but have been judged safe to humans. The human health assessment was made by the EPA because of the protein's insecticidal properties. What I provide you here is only a glimpse of the data that can be found on the EPA website. More is also found in the report. The insecticidal proteins have been found to be degraded in gastric fluids and inactivated by typical food processing. In acute toxicity in animal models, and I believe the test species was mice, both proteins were found to give no effects at levels comparable to those at which table salt would kill half the animals in the test. The EPA's overall assessment was that the protein was safe for human consumption, including children. And that's basically abstracting probably 20, 30 pages on the website. By the way, it's EPA.gov, FDA.gov, whatever you want. There's thousands and thousands of pages out there talking about health effects. The next topic that I wanted to talk about, related issues that I have grouped under segregation, fall more squarely under agronomic concerns being handled by the Ag Commissioner. Still, they could have an impact on human health should the food supply become contaminated, for instance, with a crop that had been transformed to produce a pharmaceutical. The importance here is emphasized by a couple of instances where GM crops, not approved for human consumption, have got into the food supply. The most well-known of these is the Starlink incident, where a corn approved for animal feed was found in tacos. Well up the list of potential health issues associated with GM crops is allergenic reactions caused by proteins. It is well established that proteins can cause allergenic reactions, but there are relatively few groups of plant allergens, and these are well understood and methods are available to test for them. Nonetheless, when the new food from conventional breeding, I mentioned before, the kiwi, was first marketed in the last century, allergic reactions, some quite severe, were detected for the first time. Many other current foods are known to cause allergic reactions in some people. These are labeled appropriately under FDA rules. It is also important to note that GM technology can potentially be used to remove allergens from foods, for instance, soybeans. And my last slide. My last slide goes to how GM crops are regulated. The U.S. regulatory system is based in an assessment of probable risks versus the benefit of the technology. This is different from the systems used in some other parts of the world that are heavily influenced by the precautionary principle. I've given here two definitions of the precautionary principle. They also appear in the report. So the question will always be, where is the balance? There is a continuum of people, from those that do not want any risk to those that climb mountains. It is important because, as Robbie has pointed out, it is impossible to absolutely demonstrate safety. You can only test for what seems probable. Thanks very much for your attention, and I'm going to turn this back to Lynn.
Lynn, would it be okay with you if we take a short break? I was going to say, I'm sure you'll be glad to see me because this signals the end of this report. And we can take a break, I think, before public comment, but just let me finish the conclusion here. And in conclusion, since this all began with Measure Q, which was an anti-GMO ordinance, we felt it would be of interest to this audience to see how other counties in the state have approached this issue. The source of this map is the UC Biotech website at UC Berkeley. Anti-GMO ordinances have passed in three counties. Trinity County passed an ordinance at their Board of Supervisors, and Mendocino and Marin County by ballot issues. Anti-GMO issues have been defeated at the ballot box in four counties, our county, Sonoma, Butte, and Humboldt. Lake County had a proposed ordinance voted down by their Board of Supervisors. 13 counties have passed pro-GMO resolutions at their boards of supervisors. The blue areas on the map, which sort of appear purple here, indicate proposals that are under consideration. The only link that I could find for this category, however, I couldn't find the proposals, was a website called SBGE Free in Santa Barbara. We hope that, if nothing else, the work of this task force demonstrates that regardless of political forces at work, this is not an issue that can be simplified to just pro or con. It is rather a highly complex science that may affect our health in a variety of positive and or negative aspects. Lastly, I want to thank very much the people on this list. They have worked very hard. It's been an interesting experience, I think, for all of us, and certainly very challenging. And many, many hours have gone into this report. And lastly, a copy of the final report is available to the public on this website. I believe that it will be there by tomorrow. There are a few copies available. Since it's sort of long, we didn't run a lot of copies to people who have no electronic access. And so you can check tomorrow for it on the website. And I know there are probably some people here tonight that would like a copy. And if you, I'm not sure what time tomorrow it will be available, but you can certainly call Jane and she'll send you an email. I think the people on our email list can probably get an electronic copy as well. Thank you very, very much. I think probably we'll want to take a little break and then have our public comment. Well, there should be some applause for the end.
To budget our time accordingly. One, two, three. Okay, each person will be allowed 3 minutes. We will be stopping you at 3 minutes, and that's just in respect that we would like to get out of here at a nice time tonight. And we would like to also give you the opportunity to speak, but we have several more agenda items that we need to cover. When you do come to the podium, if you'd please state your name for the record, we'd appreciate that. And would someone like to start public comment now?
And race to the microphone. I am Mike Zelena, and brace yourselves. I actually agree with most of what was said today. I think that the only concerns I have about some of the things that might have been omitted in the report, and with regards to things like there was a USDA report that came out earlier this year that when you talk about how well the agency is regulating things, an internal audit found all sorts of problems, especially in the area of things like test plots, things like these pharmaceutical and industrial crops that are out there that we don't know where they're planted. And I think, I'm sure it's included in the report and the bibliography, but it didn't come out today in the presentation, and so I want to make sure that the Health Commission has a chance to hear some of that evidence. And I think what I would like to have happen is that the board, this Health Commission, give the public a month to put together comments on this report. It came together at the very last minute, and the task force worked very hard to put this together within the last month, really. And so we haven't seen it yet, the general public. So it'd be great if it's up on the website tomorrow, give the public, both pro and con sides, a chance to look at it, make sure everything is accurate, provide, and then come back at next month's meeting and provide the commission with some public comment. Before you guys decide whether or not to accept it as is and pass it on to the Board of Supervisors. So that's what I would ask today. But I do appreciate all the effort that was put in. And again, I think the on balance, what was said was accurate. It's the question of what things are going on that were omitted that I'd have concerns with. So thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to make one comment. In the month of June, we already have a presentation, and we are dedicating the entire meeting to that. So I will share your concern with the commissioners, and Commissioner Hetherington would like to say something.
Mr. Zelena, could you make sure that the commission gets a copy of the report that you just referred to? Thank you.
I'm Eric Greening, and I agree with the idea of a continuance so that you can read the report, we can read the report, we can all ask much better questions, and if that happens in July, then that's fine. Certainly, this is a set of observations more than it's a set of recommendations, and the observations are coming from a multiplicity of sources, so we need to essentially decide what is the best way to handle the observations from a multiplicity of sources. And I think one context we should keep in mind in developing policies is the irreversibility of adopting these new crops when they do get loose in the biosphere, and the irreversibility, the unrecallability of biotic changes that get loose in the biosphere. And so that definitely, I think, calls for precautionary rather than risk assessment type thinking. One specific question that I did have that perhaps more information can be developed, one sort of mitigation that was called on if transgenic crops are going to be regularly grown in this county was the idea of segregation as a sort of a protection or a mitigation. In other words, the use of buffers so that the genetic modified crops would be grown over here and the other crops would be grown at a presumably safe distance. I have a number of problems with relying on that. One is that agriculture of any kind in this county does not require any kind of county permits. People go out and they plant what they plant. They don't file notice of what they're planting. We don't require notice of transgenic planting. That might be something we could look at. It would obviously introduce a whole new set of criteria and processes and probably new employees of the county that would be having to police this. But the other issue is we don't have the science that tell us what is an adequate buffer. We don't know to what related species something might jump. For example, can transgenic cotton jump to other members of the mallow family? can transgenic corn jump to other members of the grass family? You know, as things get developed, we may not know these things until fairly late in the process. So number one, we have no county regulatory process in place to enforce buffers as segregation. And number two, we have no science that I'm aware of to tell us what is an adequate buffer by either a risk assessment standard or the precautionary standard. And so that's just one example of something that's going to need a lot more fleshing out, but I think the time to do it is in a couple of months after we've all read it. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
My, he's good on his time. Used every second of it. Good. My name is Mark Phillips, and I'm kind of in the same boat everybody else is here. We're trying to come up with something to say intelligent about something we just now heard for the first time. I would like to also echo the request that we bring this up again in a couple of months when everybody's had a chance to look at it and submit further comments. I'd like to further request that SLOGE Free be given a opportunity to respond in something other than a 3-minute public comment period. We had a lot to do with the way this report came out, whether or not anybody wants to acknowledge that or not. It's a lot different report because of the information we provided. The vast majority of the concerns and the articles that showed problems with this technology came from SLOGE Free, and I think that we deserve that opportunity. But I would like to thank the folks that worked on this report. As far as it went, I think it was pretty good. They did bring up a lot of the issues. They also missed some, and those will be some of the things that we'd like to bring up in our comments. One in particular that really worries me and also worries the government is the way test plots are handled. And there was a report, and we're having a little trouble figuring out exactly who it was that wrote the report, but it was a report on how APHIS, which is the, what does APHIS stand for again? Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Services, is handling the requests for test plots and monitoring them. And it's a pretty damning report by another government agency looking at one of their own. That's something that I think is really important to look at. The thing about, you know, not wanting to make any predictions in their report, they said that in the beginning they weren't going to be dealing with predictions, just facts. Well, I counted about 5 or 6 predictions, and every single one of them was of what might happen, the good that might happen from GE technology. And actually, I don't mind that so much, because there are a lot of good things that can come from this technology, and we're not Luddites that don't trust any technology. We just want it handled a little bit better than it is. And all the comments about the FDA and how it's supposed to handle these things, well, that's great if it were to actually work that way. But there's a lot of evidence that shows it's not working that way. And I hope that the details of the report show that. And if not, we will certainly bring that to your attention. One of the things that I'm recently interested in, this just came up, so I can't fault them for not putting it in, but apparently there's a lot of sheep that have been eating BT cotton stalks after the harvest, and they've been dying. And that's another big thing that, you know, there's a lot of things that you got to look at. It's not just, you know, whether the crop is substantially equivalent, and even that, there's a lot of controversy on whether or not crops are substantially equivalent or not. So anyway,
thank you very much. Hi, I'm Jackie Crabb with the Farm Bureau, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Farm Bureau. We commend the members of the GMO Task Force for their hard work and the determination to stay on task, even with the personal attacks unfairly aimed at them and the perceived conspiracies to undermine their efforts. We hope that you as a commission understand what they have been faced with and the difficult tasks they have been charged with. To the task force members, thank you for a wonderful and valuable presentation. And to the commission, thank you for providing the opportunity. Thank you. Thank you very much. Next speaker.
Hi, I'm Teresa Campbell from Cambria. And I'm a little concerned about the people out there who might be wondering, you know, they're wanting to know what to think about the results of this this report and how to perhaps feed their families, if it really is safe to be feeding these foods to their families. And I think it's pretty obvious that there is no clear answer, that there really is something going on, that there is a concern. This is not just a bunch of people who are standing up and screaming and beating your chest and saying, this isn't right. There is really something going on here. There are reasons for concern. And I think that the public could just use their common sense and look around. If you're old enough to observe the differences between Americans in the past 10 or 12 years since these products have been on the market, and I don't know if people are aware of the fact that if you buy a food that's packaged, canned, bottled, it's got genetically engineered ingredients into it. So probably just about everything you're feeding your family has genetically engineered ingredients in it. And if you look at the amount of diabetes, stomach problems, other health problems, you see the ads on TV for drugs, the obesity in our children that has happened and increased in the past 10 or 12 years, common sense tells you something is going on, and it's not just because we're sitting in front of computers all the time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker. Hi.
Karen Mansfield, Executive Manager, San Luis Obispo County Agricultural Task Force. We would like to thank the members of the task force for their volunteering of time, the efforts that they made. They took on a difficult task, and they did it very well, and we really want to acknowledge that and appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi, Elizabeth Johnson, San Luis Obispo. I also want to thank the committee for their report tonight. I was interested in the whole thing. However, I'm revisiting old turf tonight, which is what I have done for 9 months, is ask two simple questions. Who picked this original task force, and what criteria were used for selection? This task force has been operating for a full year without any of you taking public responsibility for their selection. And you're lucky they did give you a good report without that. Last June, the commission chair told a nutritionist that, quote, no one who worked on Measure Q would be allowed on the task force, unquote. When asked in September who chose the committee members, the chairwoman answered, I don't know. Last July, the Farm Bureau director posted online notes that the GMO task force and the non-public GMO crop study group would present their reports together to the Board of Supervisors in December. In September, when asked who picked the task force members, she replied, I don't know. The Farm Bureau director has attended almost all task force meetings. Two leaders are responsible for the majority of references in today's report. Weed and pesticide scientist who receives corporate grant money. He was a pro-GMO spokesman against Measure Q in 2004. The other, the multinational corporate manager with crop chemical and pesticide expertise, farmer, who also wrote two editorials against Measure Q, allowing these pro-GMO pesticide experts to lead a human health issues study is absurd. It's a slap in the face to the public. The two biomedical appointees who came in January were too little, too late. The Health Commission had ample opportunity to answer these two simple questions. What and who are you protecting in your silence? If you give away a task force to a political group, perhaps like the Farm Bureau and its friends, then you undermine the foundation for public trust in your future decisions. If you accept this report and use it as an educational tool, you'll do so by pretending that this committee was legitimate, that it was created by a transparent government process. It was not. It is pretending that this committee is legitimate easier than admitting who really chose the original five members? Is it easier than admitting who demanded a lesser qualified public health employee in the second appointments? While you pretend, I'll pretend that our County Health Commission would want to ensure inclusive representation on any task force. I'll pretend that scientific neutrality would serve the public better than the corporate industrial ag cheerleading found in the GMO task force leadership. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Do we have anyone else that would like to speak?
Yes, my name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I also want to thank the GMO Task Force for their report. And I will go suggest that this come back to your group, the Health Commission, in July The Ag Commissioner, Bob Lilly, has told me that his report will be going to the Board of Supervisors on Tuesday, August 22nd. So I hope that this report could go on the same day, get it all out there on the same day. That would be my suggestion. And as far as the buffers, as Eric said, that's a good idea, but I know from talking to the Ag Commissioner that nobody has to report if they're growing a GE crop. So how would we know? How would we regulate? So first we have to have that known to the Ag Commissioners if we're going to have buffers on these crops. Finally, I'd like to make an observation on golden rice, which no third world country has accepted, even though we're told it's been offered to them free. They can't give it away. And I think one reason is that it's the only GE crop that I know of that's labeled. Maybe there's another that I don't know about. But obviously, because they made it golden, it's announcing to everybody that indeed, it is genetically engineered. So that kind of tips people off, and if they don't want it, they don't have to take it, and so far they aren't. And I've talked to you before about the fact that it is a myth, and it's just expecting people to subsist on rice when we really should be giving you people in health know we should have a varied diet, not just one crop. So let's shoot for July back at this group and August 22nd at the soups. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your comments. Do we have any other speakers? I'd like to bring it back to the commission. Do we, Commissioner Hetherington?
I too would like to thank the task force, and I would also like to thank the public that persevered in going to the meetings to make sure that it was a broadened horizon. I would like to recommend that the Health Commission take until our July meeting to look over the report. It is pretty voluminous and technical, and then bring it back in July for discussion.
Commissioner O'Dell?
I would second Pam's suggestion that we handle this in July and have our discussion in July and have adequate comment.
Commissioner Horn?
Yes, I would like to again, read to everybody under the goals part of this report that this was to take no position, either pro or con, as to whether the county should have legislation on genetically engineered foods and crops. And unfortunately, we have heard many people who have pushed and wanted that to occur. But that was not a part of our goal, and therefore, we have taken no position.
Do we have any other comments regarding this report? It is not an action item, so I don't think we can vote on whether or not we bring it back in July. We can put it on our June agenda as an action item, and vote on it at that time. Is there any other comments? I would also like to thank the GMO Task Force. I think that you did a great job, and you definitely covered every spectrum, and I know it wasn't an easy task force to be on, but I think you really you did exactly what we asked you to do, and I thank you for it. At this point, we're going to turn the meeting back over to Commissioner Enns. Thank you.
So does that mean we're bringing it back in July as an agenda item?
I think we might be wanting to have a retreat in July, so maybe we need to... Well, we need to bring it back to vote on it in June, and hopefully we'll be able to have that brief vote in our meeting that we have in June with Dr. Chasnoff. Can we put it on the agenda for June as an action item?
We can do whatever this commission desires with this report. I think we traditionally have a retreat in July to plan the following year's agenda, and so I don't know whether July is the best choice, and I'm not sure that June is a good choice if there's going to be a lot of public comment, because
we have Dr. Chasnoff, and we really need to devote our attention to that. So it's looking to me, if we're going to put it on the agenda, it would be August or later. That's my feeling. But you can change that.
Then I would like to strongly recommend that we agendize it for August. That'll still give time to get it to the Board of Supervisors if we...
And as regards the Board of Supervisors, this report was asked for by this group, the Health Commission. And I know that the Ag, Bob Lilly, would like us to make a presentation with him, and I think that we're perfectly willing to do that, but again, it is up to this group whether you want us to do that, because this is your report, not the Board of Supervisors.
Correct, and I think that we need to have the latitude, once we have a chance to digest it, to come back among ourselves at a public meeting, discuss it, and see if we, as the Health Commission, want to make some recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. I realize that that was not the purview of this task force, but it is the purview of this commission to take that information and do something with it, if we so choose.
Yes, that's correct. So, all right, then we'll have this in August. All right, then. Then let us move to our updates. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm always trying to cut out Dr. Thomas. And we really do like your public health report.
I'll try and make it a short report because it is it's been a long evening. I also would like to thank the GMO task force members. You've done yeoman's work, a challenging atmosphere, and there's a lot of science there. Science doesn't always answer the questions, but it certainly asks a lot of the right questions. We continue working on the pandemic and avian planning, and a physicians program is scheduled for June 22nd, and a community-wide summit is scheduled for June 23rd. We will bring more information next month. However, I would like to invite the health commissioners to this day-long summit on pandemic flu and avian flu. And in addition, a public health legal update and a tabletop exercise is scheduled July 13th in the afternoon to walk through what are some of the public health measures that could be taken in a pandemic situation, and then to go through a scenario and say, okay, now what would we recommend be done in this situation? How would we implement these steps? It's still important to differentiate between avian influenza, which is currently highly pathogenic, affecting chicken and waterfowl, especially in Asia and in Eastern Europe. This is responsible for infections in approximately 200 humans and has been developed through very close contact with chickens, between chickens and humans for the most part. And the reason it's so important to differentiate that is that H5N1 influenza, which is causing avian influenza, would have to go through a number of mutations to cause human-to-human transmission. While we'll be worried about and educating public about avoiding activities that would cause chicken or bird to human transmission, we are also very worried that we don't know what the probability is, but that H5N1, this avian flu, could go through transformation and become a virus that is transmitted from human to human, in which case we have very little or no immunity, and it could be a very severe pandemic. I'm saying this because tomorrow night, May 9th, there's a TV movie called Fatal Contact, Bird Flu in America. And it is a movie. It's not a documentary. It is a work of fiction designed to entertain, titillate, frighten. So while we hope that the movie does raise awareness about the issue, as I like the phrase, we hope it will inspire preparation, not panic. Somebody put a lot of work into developing that phrase. We hope it will develop preparation, not panic. So this is part of why we're doing a community-wide summit, to increase understanding and increase community and governmental and individual preparedness. The reorg of public health and the health agency is going forward at the budget hearing of the Board of Supervisors. Some of the new positions were discussed and approved at the Health Commission, I'm sorry, the Civil Service Commission, and the org chart is attached. And the big change is that there is a fiscal administrative division of the health agency. So there's a public health division, a behavioral health, which includes mental health and drug and alcohol, and a fiscal and administrative division with a deputy director in charge of that division, to which the financial lead person in public health, the financial lead person in mental health, drug and alcohol, administrative services officer in charge of personnel activities in drug and alcohol, mental health, and public health will report to him, as well as health systems, CMSP, and the information technology. And we'll have to make sure we add IT because it's not on this right now. So that should be going into effect in July. Jeff Hand is starting next Monday full-time as the new health agency director. Medical marijuana ID cards. That is a program that comes out of Senate Bill 420 from the 2003-2004 legislative session, directing the State Department of Health Services to develop an medical marijuana ID card system that county in turn are supposed to accept the written recommendation, not prescription, but recommendation from a physician or osteopath in good standing for patients who have medical conditions that those physicians feel would benefit from the use of medical marijuana. This is a voluntary program. The people don't have to have an ID card. They can carry the recommendation around with them, and it carries the same weight of law. The State Department of Health Services has finished their protocols, and now they've turned it over to county health departments to follow their protocols and move forward. The Board of Supervisors needs to designate another entity, or it is the health department to do this. So we are planning an implementation plan to do this, to go forward to the Board of Supervisors in the next month or so. And I've attached the county health status profiles for 2006, and it might be an opportunity to come forward in August when we had the study Paradox in Paradise report on health status in the Central Coast listed tentatively for August. At some point, the health status report ought to come forward in a fairly brief manner, looking at trends and issues, and I think it'd be good opportunity to do it at the same time as the Paradox in Paradise report. And I'm open for any questions.
Mr. Hetherington.
Thank you. Dr. Thomas, I was thinking that maybe this would be a good paper to have at our retreat in July so that we could discuss maybe some things that the commission finds thought-provoking and then agendize it for August.
Sure, later. Absolutely.
Good idea.
All right.
no more questions for Dr. Thomas, then we'll move on to the to our Health Commission updates. My update is that last month we had some legislative issues that we voted to support or oppose, and letters regarding that have been issued and signed to our legislators and to our lobbyists. Is that right? And then we had a letter on the fluoridation of water that we were going to send to the supervisors and the various water districts, and that's still in the works. The letter is Dr. Pinkle was kind enough to provide me with a letter that he thought would be appropriate, and we're assembling the...
I have the list of addresses of water purveyors.
Okay, and you have the list. So within the next week, this should probably go out. And then lastly, we talked about the fact that we don't get any meeting notice in the paper, and so I called and spoke to someone in the newsroom who informed me that they only list those bodies that are have regulatory authority as meeting, and because otherwise there's far too many groups that are meeting for them to put in the paper. Then I later talked with the health reporter who is here today, but he's moving on, and there'll be a new one next month. And he said that one of the things that we should probably do is make sure that we send the agenda to the email of the person who is the health reporter. And he said, but there'll be something in there this time. Well, I looked through the paper for the last few days, and I didn't find any announcement. I mean, I opened the paper this morning sure that I would be able to say we were in the paper. But that tells you how much influence I have. And I'm very sorry that those methods did not work, but perhaps this one will. So we'll now go to Commissioner update. Let's start to my left with Commissioner Pinkle. Commissioner Hetherington. Commissioner Massey. Commissioner O'Dell.
Yes, from the mental health standpoint, the Mental Health Act funds have now been approved, and they will be going to the board next Tuesday for implementation. And it is a new set of funds and a new programs. It doesn't supplement anything we're doing right now. It's a whole new thrust, which is really a full-service program for individuals. And so it has happened, and it's starting.
Okay. Commissioner Shimosis?
No report.
Commissioner Hicks?
No report.
Commissioner Horn?
Yes, I went to Children's Services Network last month, and they did... by candidates form, and so we got to see candidates from two supervisory districts and a sheriff candidate.
Commissioner Donnelly.
No report.
Well, then let us move on to the committee reports. I don't suppose the legislative committee has done anything further after their massive effort previously. Oh, Commissioner Hetherington.
I think I put somebody in touch with the SB 840 Mark and Harris. Was it Mark?
Yes, sorry. No, it wasn't. You know, I've been following those emails, and that was another subject that we were talking about doing in August, because we wanted to be able to have support or no support prior to that bill actually coming.
So we'll have a very ambitious August agenda.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I add something to that? I was at a conference this weekend, the organization is very big in supporting this proposition. And their plan of attack and information is going to start in the fall, and it will take a whole year. So there's plenty of time to get on the bandwagon and do whatever you want to do.
Okay, good. Because I think that's a very important subject and something that we need to spend at least as much time as we've spent on the GMO foods. Another year's project.
All right. All the humor aside, Commissioner Hicks on nominating?
Nominating committee. Sonia worked really hard on this, and I'd like to thank her. She's not here tonight. She's on vacation. But she put together a very fast interview schedule. We have 8 interviews scheduled for May 15th, which is next Monday, starting at 1, ending at 5. I need to ask a couple of questions. We have a couple of commissioners that I have not heard from for reapplying. They've indicated they want to reapply, but I've not received the reapplication process. There's 3 questions that we need to have you answer. I have received Commissioner Hetherington's. I'm missing Dr. Masse, Mr. O'Dell, and
I gave you mine.
There's 3 questions.
Yes, that I gave it to you at our last meeting.
Okay, I'm going to go through all my stuff.
I gave it to
you. Okay, I will go through my stuff. The other thing that I've asked the commissioners to do, I sent you all an email today asking you if you had any nominations that you would like either to nominate yourself or anyone that you feel would be a good person to either be chair, vice chair, or secretary. We're also going to be discussing that at our next meeting. And other than that, I think we're set. Thank you.
Community education.
Thank you for feeling my pain about getting the press interested. I think it'll be a good topic for the next community ed team that's put together, because I think as the commission turns over a little bit, that'll be... Oh, Dr. Thomas.
Dr. Thomas?
I think the Health Commission should look at possibly being involved in some aspects of the pandemic flu planning, educating the community about pandemic flu, avian flu, and maybe helping work with us to get a medical reserve corps, volunteer corps, going, because that's an area we haven't had enough staff or energy to really fully develop, and I think the Health Commission could help in that area.
I think I can speak for all of us that we would definitely want to support in any way we can. All right. And then has the Budget Committee met?
No, we have not. But I'd like to go back to community education. Penny, you have that thing that came from Davis.
All right.
And I would like to recommend that it talks about GMO and GMO crops and all sorts of things, and I think it's something that we should have available for the public, maybe put in the libraries, et cetera. So that people will have some kind of an understanding of what these are, and whether they're good, bad, or indifferent is up to them to come to that conclusion.
I have a handful of those. They're quite simplistic, but they're certainly useful. All right then. I think we've pretty much discussed prospective future items. We know that our next meeting is going to be on June 8th.
No.
I think it is June 8th. And which is a departure from our usual meeting time, but we are doing that so that we can have the pleasure of hearing Dr. Chasnoff speak. Is there anything else anyone would like to say about prospective future items at this time? I hear that we should adjourn, and therefore this meeting is adjourned.